Thank you all for being here. My name is Kapoom. Sometime in around the early 1970s, a great pioneer of Buddhism in the West, D.T. Suzuki, he was asked, how is Buddhism doing in America? And Suzuki said, well, you know, the first 150 years are always the hardest. So we're in the second half of that 150 years now, and I thought it might be worthwhile and interesting today to have a look at how we're doing and how we might imagine we're going in the years, decades, if not centuries to come. I have a guidebook in mind. It's the one we chose for the reading of this year's Dancing with Life gathering. It's called A New Buddhist Path, Enlightenment, Evolution, and Ethics in the Modern World by David R. Loy. I've been for some years impressed by this writer and teacher. He's a professor of Buddhism in Boulder, Colorado. He's a Japanese Zen teacher in that community. And many people who like to read Buddhist books like me would first have come to know him for a book called Money, Sex, War, Karma, Notes for a Buddhist Revolution. A rather bold title. I also really liked The World is Made of Stories, a gentle work of many voices. All of his writing is inclusive. His page is like an intellectual collage. I intend to read now, but originally wasn't inclined towards one that he co-authored with his wife, who's an English literature professor, and it's called The Dharma of Dragons and Demons, Buddhist Themes in Modern Fantasy. I thought that was a little bit over the top, but then I read something more recently about what he said about Lord of the Rings. Now, Lord of the Rings, now that was the story of my young fatherhood life. My son had the trilogy plus The Hobbit read to him aloud no less than 4 times in entirety. When the movies came out, he took us to them. His parents sat with him front center, IMAX opening night, and he gave me the box set extended edition for a Christmas present. So I thought, okay, I know Lord of the Rings. I know about the battle of good versus evil, right over wrong, and the vanquishing of the dragon. But then Loy said, no, it's not about that really. It's about letting go. Well, I'm interested. What does he mean? Well, but then, okay, Frodo at the Mount Doom in the fires has to throw the ring away. He has to let go in order to free everyone and himself. At first, probably not going to get out of this one alive, but then it turns out very okay for him too. I thought, okay, I'm gonna order that book. I'm gonna read that book. Get some revision to my thinking. A New Buddhist Path, the book, and the future itself, it features a lot of letting go. And I guess it also will bring us to a lot of building up according to our highest values. I really like the book. I read it twice. I'm going to learn a lot from it, reading it about 10 more times during the months to come with Dancing with Life. It begins with the line, "May you live in interesting times." And that quote is an ancient Chinese curse, of course. No doubt our times are extremely interesting, very dangerous. In this modern age, our human culture has ascended to dominate and subjugate the planet. We seem to be on a path to destroy the world, eventually, for ourselves and along the way for beings so varied and numerous that we've only just begun to recognize them. Buddhism is always adapted to the culture when it arrived, to the existing culture. And over 25 centuries of traveling the globe, it has become the third biggest religion. One out of every 13 people identify as Buddhist. The range of practices and beliefs is astounding and disparate among us. When Buddhism went from India to China, it encountered Taoism, and that conflation became Chan or Zen. when it ascended the Himalayas later to the fierce kingdoms of Tibet, it met the animist Bon faith, and Tibetan Buddhism evolved. My first commitment, formally, to Buddhism was when I joined a Tibetan Buddhist Sangha. Our teacher, the guru, we called him Rinpoche. He was the seventh reincarnated tulku of Dachong in Western Tibet. That is quite a different practice we had there. Our retreats were 9 days long, but they weren't silent. In fact, we chanted, reciting with a mantra, with a mala, like a prayer bead of 108 beads. And we did this all day. We did it though 9 to 5, and then we'd go home at night. And the meals weren't vegetarian. Right? So it's just different from what we do here in this Korean Zen lineage. When I moved into this Zen temple 10 years ago now, when I lived here for almost 8 years, I think, and I'd frequently be asked, what kind of Buddhist are you, John or Kapoom? And I'd say, okay, I'm a Canadian Buddhist. I'd say, well, what kind of Buddhist is that? What the heck is that? He says, well, I'd say, a Canadian Buddhist is a person who's as Buddhist as possible under the circumstances. So what do you say to people what kind of Buddhist you are and are going to become in your life? As we adopt to this 21st century culture, what's our future? Another voice in this book is Arnold Toynbee. He was a Harvard philosophy history professor and noted historian. Before he died in 1975, he reflected on this, and I'm going to quote, "The present threat to mankind's survival can be removed only by a revolutionary change of heart in individual human beings. This change of heart must be inspired by religion in order to generate the willpower needed for putting arduous new ideals into practice." Wow, now, more than 40 years later, almost every day, I run into somebody or overhear somebody talking about just such a personal and societal transformation, a new cultural movement in which we as a species and as individuals evolve from treating this planet as a collection of objects to relating to a communion of subjects. Those are the terms of Thomas Berry, another voice in this book, talking about a universe story, a new religion. Another deep ecologist. Toynbee also famously said that the introduction of Buddhism in the West, quote, may well prove to be the most important event of the 20th century. Oh, that's big. I mean, really? The most important event of the 20th century? Does that mean I'm supposed to do something now? He said also that civilizations die not by murder, but by suicide. And we have a culture of addictions in this civilization. And more often than not, when you scratch serious addiction, you uncover a process of self-destruction. But I'm a Buddhist, and so aren't I supposed to be deconstructing myself? I mean, I'm supposed to be taking self apart, realizing its fragmentary nature, assuming the truth of not-self. Well, yes, I think, but just a minute. Let's not get ahead of this story here. I mean my reasonable Canadian Buddhist story here. And go back to Loy. He points out that North American Buddhists tend to fall into one of two basic streams. This is an oversimplification, but I think useful. Two prevailing theories, which we might call the traditional and the secular. And he summarizes the traditional like this. He says, some adjustments, this is what traditionalists would think. He says, some adjustments need to be made, of course, but without conceding any significant alteration in the basic teaching and ways of practicing. That such traditions are pre-modern is not a weakness, but it's their strength, given what the modern world has become and where it seems to be going. The prevalent Western worldview promotes individualism and narcissism. Its economic system encourages greed, and society as a whole seems to be entranced in consumerist addictions and fantasies. We need to revitalize this ancient wisdom that can put us back into the right direction. On the other hand, the secular approach, with its desire to supplant the old Iron Age mythology with a Buddhism that's more relevant to the contemporary world, to information, to hope, knowledge. Loy summarizes the secular viewpoint with this kind of talk. Sure, modernity has its problems, but we must build on the best of what it has discovered. This includes not only hard scientists, such as physics and biology, but also social sciences, such as psychology, sociology. Instead of accepting pre-modern beliefs that are no longer plausible today, we can also benefit from what anthropology and archaeology, for example, have learned about ancient ways of thinking. Only that approach can develop a Buddhism that speaks directly to our situation today, the dis-ease of modern people living in this globalizing world. Okay. Reading these two ostensibly opposing positions, I confess that I totally agree with both of them. I feel like that queen in Alice in Wonderland. You know, he practices believing in impossible things for a half an hour every day. And she said to Alice that some days she believed in as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast. I can do that before breakfast, too. Similarly, you know, such a Canadian Buddhist that around debates such as that about enlightenment, I don't know. I hear people advocating the attainment of perfect Buddhahood, this transcendent end to all attachment and suffering. It sounds to me like Christians or Muslims talking about a paradise above. And paradise, that was my first real idea that I was totally addicted to. At the age of 8, it came to me in a nautical version, actually. I was devoted to the idea of escaping to the South Pacific on a sailboat. Paradise, no suffering. White boat, blue seas, verdant islands. And still, I'm all for letting go of craving and realizing freedom from suffering with my wife. Go there, okay. But now I'm also a big believer in programs of emotional healing and psychological growth. Therapy, mindfulness practices. And also for me, in the application of Buddhism's 4 immeasurables, loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity. Amen to that in every ordinary day. I've never met a person I could truly say was enlightened. Even my 7th reincarnated Rinpoche Tulku from ancient Tibet, a beautiful person, now retired, living in Winnipeg. And while I devote my days to wellness practices, and I have a great relationship with my own therapist, I admit, I have to quote another of the voices in Loy's book, the eminent child psychologist, Donald Winnicott. He said, "Absence of psychoneurotic illness may be health, but it is not life. We are poor indeed if we are only sane." Buddhism surely doesn't stop with being only sane, right? It's more than the mindfulness and psychological wellness business. It's not unreasonable to believe that the new path of our Buddhist intentions and practices can guide us beyond dis-ease, uncovering a flourishing human beingness, even considering the dire circumstances of our extremely interesting times. And that's what David Loy is teaching, and that's why I'm excited about studying the book with some of you, as many of you as possible, as is reasonable under the circumstances, I mean. Is it preaching a new religion? Not yet, anyway. Maybe someday we will be. I don't know. It isn't taking a position on the current debates between the traditional and the secular. But what he's advocating is to be engaged in a meaningful, mutually respectful dialogue, a conversation. It's actually a big deal to inspire a new dialogue. And it's a very Buddhist thing to do, I think, to see our way beyond our knee-jerk reactions and jealously guarded positions. And he gives us a handy tool to see this way forward. It's kind of like a pair of binoculars. And the two lenses are the teachings of not self and of the non-dwelling mind. He doesn't pretend to have the answers, Lloyd doesn't. He's not drawing any blueprints for the future of this religion. But he is inspiring a way of paying attention with an open heart and an open mind. That's a very big deal. That's a very big deal indeed. Now, even before picking up his binoculars, though, set aside the notion that the traditional view is what the Buddha taught, and the alternative is scientific reasoning and reductionism. That's just not a duality that is pertinent here. Both Orthodox and postmodern practitioners are citing the Buddha, referring to the latest translations. I mean, the traditionalists, you know, like Thanissaro Bhikkhu, Bhikkhu Bodhi, they are really up to date with linguistics, and their translations are very challenging to many of the viewpoints that those of us who have been around for a while grew up with. So the so-called traditional view, or the orthodox view, is very much today's highest level of scholarship. They're a far cry from those 19th century colonialists who encountered Buddhism as some kind of exotic oriental faith or cultural tradition, and their translations of the sutras were through a filter of mainly Christian culture. They tried their best, but it was a different time, right? different viewpoint. And the science of this century, I mean, it's full of mystery and wonder. And it's a delight to watch theoretical physicists dance with ancient mystics, venerable wisdom traditions. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. The Heart Sutra. I don't have it with me. I just read a book. It's called A Universe from Nothing, Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing, by Lawrence Krauss. Some of you are likely among the millions who have seen this theoretical physicist, cosmologist on YouTube. I love these kind of coincidences. He talks about form and emptiness from a cosmological, theoretical physicist point of view. And then the coincidence is reading that book of knowledge, scientific knowledge, in the afternoon. The next morning, I pick up a brand new Buddhist book, Single White Monk, Tales of Death, Failure, and Bad Sex, although not necessarily in that order, by Shosan Jack Hobner. And it's a, this is a beautiful book. This is a beautiful book. But then the second page, why is there something rather than nothing? Nothingness makes so much more sense. I love that kind of coincidence, when the knowledge of the afternoon and the inspiration of spiritual reading in the morning dovetail like that. That's very delightful. And as Krauss said, Mother Nature doesn't care about what makes sense to the human brain. Right? In the creation of the world, that's not a factor. We have to stretch. We have to change. We have to learn in order just to pay attention properly to our observations. And realizing what the Buddha really thought and taught, it's part of our processes for all of us every day, every new day, wherever we see his voice, wherever we hear him. This open-minded way of paying attention, this pair of binoculars that Loy is handing us, it's as beautiful as it is useful. Because like for Frodo in the ring, it's about stepping away from the battle between good and evil and right and wrong, about taking a breather for a moment from the important business of dragon slaying, to let go of who you thought you were and what you thought you had to believe in. This non-dwelling mind, it's a mind that does not identify with any dogma or any ideology in particular, whether religious or secular, spiritual or scientific. The non-dwelling mind is not addicted to anything, including the expression of opinions. I mean, how liberating. We don't have to have an opinion all the time about everything. The non-dwelling mind is light, subtle, supple. It can adapt to new circumstances because it lacks a separate and fixed form of its own. Positions find no purchase here. To the non-dwelling mind, awakening is neither an escape into some transcendence nor the acceptance of this world as it is. The lens of not-self, anatta, is exactly this too. It is a reconstruction and a deconstruction of the self in a non-dual, value-based, therefore immeasurably rich process. I'd like to conclude by reading More from David Lloyd, but this is from where he teaches, straight out of the classic texts. First from the Diamond Sutra. He says, "Let your mind come forth," the Diamond Sutra says, "without fixing it anywhere." And Lloyd comments, he says, "Perhaps the most important Chan or Zen text of all, the Platform Sutra of the sixth patriarch Hunan," that's about the 8th century when he lived, "makes and remakes the same point about attachment and non-attachment. It says, when our mind works freely without any hindrance and is at liberty to come or go, we attain liberation. Such a mind is everywhere present, yet it sticks nowhere." Hunang, who was probably illiterate, emphasized that he had no system of Dharma to transmit. He said, "What I do to my disciples is to liberate them from their own bondage with such devices as the case may need." Such devices as the case may need. He sounded sort of like a Canadian Buddhist, I think, the sixth and last patriarch of ancient China. Coincidence. Huhei, another Chan master who lived about a century later, elaborated on the nature of the liberated mind. He said, "Here's a lesson. Should your mind wander away, do not follow it, whereupon your wandering mind will stop wandering of its own accord. Should your mind desire to linger somewhere, do not follow it, and do not dwell there, whereupon your mind's questing for a dwelling place will cease of its own accord. Thereby you will come to possess a non-dwelling mind, a mind that remains in the state of non-dwelling. This full awareness in yourself of a mind dwelling upon nothing is known as having a clear perception of your own mind, or in other words, as having a clear perception of your own nature. A mind which dwells upon nothing is the Buddha mind, the mind of one already delivered, the Bodhi mind, the uncreated mind." Now, if all these capital letters of mind, Bodhi mind, and uncreated mind are pointing to something other than our usual self and mind, we can rely on another Chan master, 9th century now, another century later, Huang Po. It's evolving, but what is it evolving to? Huang Po deflates all delusions about transcendence. He was asked, "From all that you have said, mind, capital, is Buddha, capital. But it is not clear as to what sort of mind is meant by this mind, which is Buddha." And Huang Po answered the student, "How many minds have you got?" The student said, "But is the Buddha the ordinary mind of the enlightened mind?" And Huang Po asked the student, "Where on earth do you keep your ordinary mind and your enlightened mind?" A familiar implication here is the Chan Zen insistence of enlightenment as nothing more than realizing the true nature of ordinary activities of one's everyday mind. When Huaihei was asked about his own practice, he replied, "When I'm hungry, I eat. When I'm tired, I sleep." And with gratitude, I think it's probably time to have lunch and take a nap. Thank you very much, as always, for your kind and generous listening.